This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We talk a lot about whether science fiction inspires scientists, and here's a movie that actually did, Terminator 2. That gloopy, slurpy, slithering sound you're hearing now is the character T-1000. He's shifting from a liquid blob into a solid robot assassin. This scene inspired scientists from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill to develop a new kind of 3D printer that works with liquid. Joining me now are two graduate students from UNC who will be putting this new printing technique to use, Ashley Johnson and Rina Januszewicz. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Well, thank you so much.
Tell us about, Ashley, what makes this 3D printer different from conventional ones?
This 3D printer is about 25 to 100 times faster than any other 3D printer on the marketplace at this time. It's really exciting because this 3D printer prints continuously rather than in a layer-by-layer fashion. So most 3D printers are really 2D printing over and over and over again. But instead of using this 2D layered technique, this printer works by playing a UV movie. So light shines through an oxygen-permeable window while a part is continuously pulled out of a liquid resin. In this way, a part is created from a liquid into a solid, similar to the T-1000 in Terminator 2.
So it's sort of like you're pulling like reverse can, making a candle. It's sort of coming out as you lift it up. It's forming as it comes out of the liquid.
Exactly.
Yeah. How does it work? I mean, what is the liquid made out of first? Tell us what that is.
So the liquid, we're kind of call it a resin, and it's it's something that's called a photocurable resin. So basically, it's these little monomers that once you shine light on them, polymerize and solidify into a part. And so what Ashley was talking about is this UV video, we can selectively say where the part is going to polymerize. The importance of the oxygen permeable window is that polymerization or solidification can't happen in the presence of oxygen. So above the oxygen permeable window is actually something we call a dead zone, where polymerization or solidification isn't even happening. And so because of that, we're able to go at much faster speeds because there's not like this layer by layer process. It just literally grows out of this puddle that is always there.
So instead of taking hours to print something, you can do it in a matter of minutes?
Yes, sir.
Exactly. Yeah. So if Joe, the CEO of Carbon 3D, actually just did a TED Talk when he printed this geometric ball in 6.5 minutes. And other 3D printers would take about 11.5 hours to print that part.
Wow. Can you make it out of other materials than this plastic resin? Can you use metal or anything else? Or are you now solely on plastic?
So right now we're focused on polymers just because there's so much in the field. And Joe talks about just pretty much throwing the polymer handbook at CLIP, or continuous liquid interface production, and just seeing what we can get out of it. So there's a lot of polymers that are photocurable. And then we also have the capacity to functionalize other resins and make those also photocurable. So in that regard, there's a huge open area in terms of things that we can play with. But yeah, metals are on the horizon. We're definitely looking toward expanding beyond just polymers.
Ashley, what are you going to be using these 3D printers to make?
So my research currently focuses on the production of microneedles using CLIP. These are really interesting drug delivery devices. So rather than giving a shot with a hypodermic needle, which a lot of people are afraid of, causes a lot of pain, you can use microneedles, which are less than a millimeter in height, to deliver the same drug. So we've been using CLIP to make these microneedles in about 3 minutes, whereas other techniques would take on the order of hours to months to make the same devices.
Can you build new structures with this kind of 3D printer?
We absolutely can. There are a lot of structures that are really difficult to make using traditional injection molding techniques, such as undercut structures. So if you think about something like a T or an arrowhead, where you have something that's much larger at the top of the structure than at the base, it's impossible to mold that type of part. So we're interested in making microneedles, so needles that insert into the skin that are say like an arrowhead. And these devices would remain in the skin and not bounce back out when they're put into the skin.
So are you thinking more then of personal applications than, say, industrial applications at this point?
This technique is really exciting to bridge both of those different industries. So one of the big advantages of Clip is that it is so much faster. 3D printing traditionally has been limited to prototyping. So, you know, people that would have a 3D printer such as a MakerBot in their basement and use that to make different prototypes. Because it's so much faster, you can actually use this device for mass manufacturing of different parts.
Mm-hmm. And because you're talking about microneedles, I guess it allows you to make really tiny parts that you couldn't make with conventional 3D printing.
So we actually just published a science paper on this technology. And as a part of that paper, I was able to produce some parts that are really small, so down to 50 microns, which is about the width of a human hair.
Wow. Wow. That's for needle making? Or what other kinds of things can you do with something that can get that small?
So we're also looking into something called printing a porous structure. So the cool thing with Clip, because it is so fast and is actually layerless, what it generates is a monolithic part or a part that's all one object. So with traditional printing, it's just a series of 2D objects stacked on each other. So a monolithic part is just one giant part. And because it's monolithic, it allows us to print large overhangs, which we don't need supports for. So if you think of a sphere or a void volume, which is what a pore is, if you try to construct that, the first couple of layers you're building outward, and then halfway through you have to start building inward. And that's just a lot of strain on the material. But because we're all monolithic, we can actually print those parts pretty easily. And so we're really interested in investigating porosity and porous structures in terms of biological scaffolds for cell seeding or even water purification membranes. So the applications really vary once we're able to access this really new geometry.
All right. Thank you very much. Fascinating. We'll be keeping track and watching how this new printer works. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Ashley Johnson and Rima Janutovic talking about their new printer. At the top of the hour, we took a short trip to the Cosmic Cafe. Remember that? Yes. We sat down, had a little bit to eat there. It's a little imagined restaurant in the cosmos of your mind, made up of all the mysterious good stuff in our universe. You got your dark matter and your energy, gravity waves, even the fabled string theory. There is more strange comic news to chew on this week. News that dark matter is even more dark than had been anticipated. Dark matter doesn't interact with itself as much as had been thought, says this new research. Joining us to digest this news and all the other entrees in our Cosmic Cafe is Nobel Prize winner Steve Weinberg. He's a theoretical physicist at the University of Texas at Austin, also author of the new book, To Explain the World, The Discovery of Modern Science, published by HarperCollins. Welcome back to Science Friday. Good to have you back.
Good afternoon. Nice to be back.
Nice to have you back. Let's talk about this. Did you see the news that the dark matter is not as dark as is darker than we thought with the colliding galaxies? Can you explain what's going on there?
Yes, I did see the news, and it's very exciting. In the past, there has been one discovery of a colliding cluster of galaxies in which, by studying the bending of light from more distant galaxies, it's been possible to map out the so-called dark matter and see that the dark matter, when two clouds of it from the two clusters of galaxies collide with each other, nothing happens. It just goes whizzing right through. Now they have 72 of these colliding clusters of galaxies, and it's all pinned down much more accurately with better statistics, and it seems really true that the dark matter particles don't interact with anything, not even themselves, except for gravity. They do interact with gravity, and they produce gravity, and that's how we know about them.
Wow. So, in other words, you would think that the particles for themselves should be clumping together, but they're not?
Apparently not. They don't like each other any more than they like ordinary atoms.
So does that upset the apple cart once again in the strange cosmic world?
Oh, I wouldn't say it upset the apple cart because we didn't have an apple cart. We have a number of tentative possible theories of dark matter, none of which you can take to the bank. None of them can be taken very seriously. And this agrees with some and disagrees with other, but it doesn't matter much because none of these theories has had any degree of confirmation.
Well, why have we had such a paucity of theories that might work?
Well, you know, there is that word dark. It's these particles are not seen except for their gravitational force. But part of the reason it's so mysterious is that we have a very good theory of elementary particles and the forces that act on them. Everything we can study in our laboratory except gravity, called the Standard Model. And the Standard Model, in its current simplest form, just doesn't have any room for these dark matter particles. There's no particle described by the dark matter, by the Standard Model that could be the dark matter. So it's got to be something else. Well, no one ever thought the Standard Model was the last word. It's easy to think of extensions of the theory that could contain dark matter particles. The trouble is it's too easy. We can think of too many ways of extending it.
All right. We're going to come back and talk lots more with Steven Weinberg, author of To Explain the World, The Discovery of Modern Science. Our number, 844-724-8255, if you'd like to get in on the conversation. We're talking dark matter. We'll get into, I know, one of Steve's favorite topics, dark energy. We'll talk about that and anything else that has to do with the cosmos. You can also tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the cosmology. We're talking about the universe, what it's made of, and the strange dark elements, dark matter, dark energy. Maybe we'll get into gravity waves, graviton, string theory, all kinds of good stuff. Talking with Steven Weinberg, Nobel Prize winner and author of the new book, To Explain the World, The Discovery of Modern Science, published by HarperCollins. Joining us also now is Dan Hooper, staff scientist at Fermilab, professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of Chicago. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Jody Cooley is associate professor of physics at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now we have a theoretical physicist and we have experimental physicists. I know, Jody, that you're an experimental physicist. Do you play well with a theoretical physicist?
Well, I like to think so. I'm not sure if they feel the same way or not. But I think it's really important that you have both experimentalists and you have theorists working together on such a difficult problem.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the dark matter, which we started off with Stephen talking about it. As an experimentalist, can you perform any experiments or to see what the dark matter is made out of?
Well, as a matter of fact, we can, and there are different types of experiments that we can perform. The types of experiments that we perform kind of fall into three different categories. And Stephen had already talked about sort of the first kind, where you're looking at dark matter particles interacting with other dark matter particles in the article that appeared, I guess it was yesterday. The other way that you can look for dark matter particles is waiting. Dark matter is thought to be in the galaxy all around us. Mm. And so by building experiments here on Earth, we can wait and try to detect the dark matter interacting actually in the experiments here on the Earth. And so that's the sort of dark matter detection that I work on. The third way you could do it is you could actually, in a collider, like at the Large Hadron Collider, collide together ordinary matter and look for dark matter coming out.
Is that contemplated? They're just tweaking it up to come back online. Is that something they might be looking for?
I do believe they are. They have a working group at the Large Hadron Collider. Both the ATLAS and the CMS collaborations both have working groups with people who are looking for a missing energy signature that could be a hint of a dark matter signal that they see.
Dan Hooper, you hold out hope for that?
I do. I'm an eternal optimist. The sort of experiments that Jody's been talking about and Steve mentioned before are all reaching the level of sensitivity that we've long expected would be necessary to test a very wide variety of theoretical hypotheses for what the dark matter might be made of. We have a lot of good theoretical ideas. I think Steve's right that the problem is it's too easy to write down theories like this. But if you take them as an entirety of hypotheses, an awful lot of them will be tested in the next few years, either by the Large Hadron Collider or by the underground experiments like the ones that Jody works on, or by these gamma ray and cosmic ray telescopes that are looking for dark matter particles interacting among themselves.
Stephen Weinberg, do you have any guess where they might be found first, either on this planet or outside?
I think that Jody and Dan know much more than I do about current experiments, so you better ask them which experiment is likely to bear fruit first. If you ask me what's my guess as to what the dark matter particles are, I don't have much of a better answer. We've been imagining, this is something that goes back in my own life for many decades, heavy, weakly interacting, massive particles of a kind that are predicted by various extensions of the Standard Model. And that's the kind of particle that could be found at CERN or in the other experiments that were mentioned. There's another possibility, though, a very, very light particle called the axion that, if it's the dark matter, would be present in enormous numbers. And that's not going to be discovered at the Large Hadron Collider or anywhere else that I can imagine. And that would be really a trick to find.
Mm-hmm. Our number 844-724-8255. People are talking about dark matter, dark energy. Let's talk about dark energy now, Stephen. Something really, really out there.
Yeah, dark energy is much more mysterious than dark matter. Dark matter is some kind of particle we haven't discovered yet. And nobody thinks that we have discovered all the particles that exist. And it has certain rather simple properties, doesn't interact much with stuff. Dark energy is not in particles. It's an energy that we think is in space itself. And you can't get it out because you can't create or destroy space. It's just there. And the only way we know about it is because it's gravitational attraction or repulsion affects the expansion of the universe. There always was a question, ever since Einstein formulated general relativity and then began to apply it in 1917 to the whole universe, there always was a question, what is the energy in empty space? And the answer generally has been assumed to be zero. But, you know, we can calculate various contributions to it, and they're not zero. They're enormous, much larger than astronomical observations allow. So there has to be some kind of cancellation of all these very large contributions to the energy of empty space, which makes it really mysterious. It's a kind of fine-tuning of nature to make all the different contributions to dark energy nearly cancel. Which it's a kind of fine-tuning which has bedeviled the whole history of science, going back to when Ptolemy developed the theory of the motion of the planets, in which was fine-tuned so that the center of the epicycle of Venus was always on the line between the Earth and the Sun. Whenever we observe this kind of fine-tuning, we make things have to be assumed to be equal when there's no possible reason for them to be equal. Whenever we see that, it's a sure sign that there's something deep that we don't understand.
All right, let's go.
And right now, dark energy is such a thing.
Yeah, it's pretty mysterious. Let's go to Rick in Norwich, New York. Is it New York, Rick?
Yes, it's New York.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, the question is, and this is going to sound like something right out of science fiction, if dark matter or dark energy were to hit the Earth, would anything happen? I mean, would there be a great cataclysm and all life on Earth would be snuffed out as we know it, or would we just pass right through it?
Dan, you want to answer that?
Sure. Every second of every day, dark matter particles are bombarding all of our bodies, and really nothing happens. So the question I like to pose to people is not why doesn't dark matter impact ordinary matter, but why does ordinary matter impact ordinary matter. And the reason it does is because ordinary matter has electric charge in it. And when I push my hand into the wall, it's the electric charge of the electrons pushing against each other that prevents my hand from going through it. Now, dark matter doesn't have any of that charge, so those dark matter particles travel straight through our bodies and in fact, straight through the Earth, leaving no impact at all, except in a very, very small fraction of instances, and those are the small instances that we're trying to detect. But the vast, vast majority of those dark matter particles act as if the Earth was never here, except for the Earth's gravity.
How was dark matter first discovered, Dan?
Well, it depends who you ask. The first indications of dark matter go back to the 1930s when Fritz Zwicky and others noticed that the Coma cluster of galaxies really required an exceptional amount of gravity just to be held together. And one of the hypotheses raised back then was that there might be a lot of invisible matter, stuff we'd call dark matter today. And then later, people like Vera Rubin and others noticed a similar conclusion when they looked at the way that galaxies rotated. And then in more recent times, we see very compelling evidence of dark matter in the detailed patterns in the cosmic microwave background. That tells us not only that there's a lot of missing mass, but it's quite cold or not moving very quickly. And then I think earlier you talked about this new paper about colliding galaxy clusters, and that provides some of the strongest evidence to date as well. Not only that there seems to be missing mass, but that missing mass really doesn't seem to interact with itself very much. It looks pretty inert or weakly interacting.
Mm-hmm. Jody Cooley, are there any theoretical alternatives to dark energy and dark matter?
Well, I don't know of any alternatives to dark energy. Steven Weinberg could probably address that more appropriately. But as far as dark matter, there are alternative theories. So I think most people are in the case for dark matter being a particle is really quite compelling. And it's my belief personally that dark matter is a particle. However, there are some scientists out there and there are some people who think that dark matter could be explained by modifying our theories of gravity, and that if we made a modification to it, we could not need dark matter as a particle, but we would just, you know, adjust these equations. The difficulty with that, those theories are, is although they can explain some of the evidence that we've seen, you know, for dark matter existing, some of the gravitational evidence that we see in telescopes, it doesn't quite explain everything. And so there's not really a theory out there that really explains all the evidence that we see as a modified theory of gravity. And so really, I think the most compelling theory out there is that dark matter is a particle.
Stephen, you would agree with that?
Absolutely. I think if all we knew was that the Comer cluster held together more than you would expect, given the speed of the galaxies within the cluster, then modification of Newton's theory of gravity would be a reasonable approach. But as Dan said, there are so many, and Jody said, there are so many pieces of evidence now for dark matter, particularly these exquisite measurements of the cosmic microwave background, that I think it would just be amazing. Also, you know, it's much more difficult theoretically to introduce modifications to Newton's theory than it is to introduce another particle. Mm-hmm. Introducing another particle is no sweat at all.
You used to have a zoo of them, remember?
Yeah, that's the trouble.
I can do that three times before breakfast.
I know that Dan does that three times before breakfast.
And no one can prove you wrong, right?
Yeah. Well, as Hotspur says in Henry IV, yes, I can introduce new particles, and so can anyone, but when you introduce them, will they be found?
In case you're just joining us, we're talking with Nobel Prize winner Steven Weinberg, who is a theoretical physicist at the University of Texas at Austin and author of a really cool new book, To Explain the World, The Discovery of Modern Science. Also, Jody Cooley, associate professor at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. Dan Hooper, chief staff scientist at Fermilab, professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of Chicago. You ever get to talk with Leon Letterman, Dan? See?
I've talked to him a few times. He's retired these days, so he's not around the lab anymore.
Yeah, well, give him my regards. He's a longtime colleague and friend. Let's talk about, Stephen, one of the most really unusual things about dark energy, and you talked about this last time, is a mind-blowing thing, is one, is that First of all, it didn't kick in. It hasn't been around all the time in the history of the universe. And two, there should be a whole lot more of it than we find, right?
Yes. Well, I have to correct, although what you say is effectively correct, it needs a little correction. The dark energy, according to the most popular picture, has always been there. It has, at least since the very beginning of the Big Bang, it has now the same value that it's had for billions of years. It's just the universe has expanded during this period, and the other energy, the energy in the matter of galaxies rushing apart from each other, the amount of that per volume of space has been steadily decreasing. And now the dark energy is just beginning to stick its head above the water. Mm. It's beginning to be bigger than the energy and everything else. In fact, according to measurements of the way the universe is expanding, it's about three times the energy in everything else, including the dark matter. Mm. In fact, the only way we know this is because it causes the expansion of the universe to accelerate, whereas everything else, because it produces a gravitational force, an attractive force, causes the expansion of the universe to slow down. So it's the discovery of the acceleration of the expansion that so far is our only clue to the dark energy.
Let me remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And that means everything that we see with our eyes, anything that's visible, is only about, what, 4% of the whole universe? Everything else is dark energy and dark matter?
That's about right, 4% for ordinary stuff like mm-hmm. us. And that's, you know, from a certain point of view, that's just the contamination. The rest of the universe is about 25% dark matter and about 75% dark energy.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that you're saying even though there's all this dark energy, there really should be a lot more of it that we should be discovering?
Well, you know, according to quantum mechanics, it's not possible for things like the electric and the magnetic and the gravitational field to simply be zero in empty space. Quantum mechanics requires them to be continually fluctuating. If you calculate the energy in those fluctuating fields, it depends on what's the shortest wavelength that you're willing to consider. If you calculate the energy down to the shortest wavelength that we think we know anything about a hundredth the size of an atomic nucleus, it's too large. It's too large by a number like a 1 with 56 zeros. When I say it's too large, I mean judging from the way the universe is expanding. If the dark energy were that large, the whole universe would have expanded in an instant, and there would never have been any stars or galaxies or people. So the question is, what's canceling these well-understood contributions to the dark energy? And we can think of various things that are canceling it, including a constant that Einstein introduced into his theories in 1917. But why should the cancellation be that good? I mean, you just know there's something wrong if you have to rely on a cancellation that's good to 56 decimal places. Wow. That's not the kind of theory you want.
We're going to take a break and let your hair stop hurting for a little bit and come back and talk lots more with Dan Hooper, Jody Cooley, and Steven Weinberg. If you have a question, our number 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us, yes, at SciFry, get a question in that way. We'll be taking lots of questions after the break. Lots of you have those questions. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about dark energy, dark matter, cosmology, all kinds of good stuff with my guest Steven Weinberg, Jody Cooley, and Dan Hooper. And your calls, 844-724-8255. Steven Weinberg is author of the new book, To Explain the World, The Discovery of Modern Science, published by HarperCollins. Let me begin with that, the conundrum. Talking about the history of science, Steven, can you compare this conundrum about we just don't know what's going on with any other period of science?
I can compare it with every other period of science. People have always confronted mysteries. But what's different about modern science is that we have different ways of resolving those mysteries, different standards for what we would think would be an explanation. For example, just as we wonder what dark matter and dark energy are, the Greeks, in the time before Socrates, wondered what matter is, what the ordinary stuff around us is. And they made up various theories. It's all water. It's all air. It's fire. It's atoms. Sometimes they guessed right, like the idea of atoms. Sometimes they guessed wrong when they said it was all water. But the big difference is not that they were more wrong than we are, but that their theories had no bite. There was nothing you could do with them, and they never tried to justify the theories either by mathematical analysis or certainly not by experiment. Mm-hmm. You've been hearing in this program Jody and Dan talking about the difficult, expensive experiments and observations that are done both here on Earth and astronomically to try to settle this question of what this mysterious stuff, dark energy and dark matter, is. And nobody's going to believe any theory, and we have lots of theories, until it is confirmed observationally and experimentally. That spirit is what you don't find in the ancient world, certainly not until the center of intellectual life moved away from Athens to Alexandria mm-hmm. in the Hellenistic period. Mm-hmm.
Dan Hooper, do you think innovation in physics today compares to that of, let's say, the 60s and the 70s?
Well, in many ways, the 60s and the 50s, 60s, and 70s were a golden era in particle physics, my field and Stephen's and Jody's, where there seemed to be a new particle discovered in an accelerator, you know, every few months for a while, and new theories were being proposed and confirmed, you know, one after the other. Our field earned a lot of Nobel Prizes during that period of time. And things are a little slower now. But in my relatively short career, I've been a practicing physicist for about 15 years. And in that time, we became convinced that dark energy exists. That's an enormous undertaking. Around that time, when I was just starting, the idea that neutrinos had mass and could convert spontaneously into other types of neutrinos, that was a new discovery. Just a couple of years ago, we discovered the Higgs boson. Something like 5 or so years ago, we saw this new concrete evidence that dark matter exists from these colliding clusters. So a lot of stuff is advancing, and I'm optimistic that with the next run of the Large Hadron Collider and the next round of dark matter experiments, we're going to test a lot of theories, and there's, in my view, a pretty good chance that we'll make new discoveries that are not anything we've predicted so far.
Stephen, are you as optimistic, or are you more discouraged by the state of the field today?
I counsel patience. You know, Democritus speculated about atoms, and it took more than 2,000 years to get direct evidence that atoms existed. It turned out that they were 100 million times smaller than Democritus was. We face now, when we talk about going beyond the Standard Model, a much larger reach in scale. The fundamental theories like string theory, which is supposed to tie everything up, are at energy scales that are just inaccessible to us. So it's going to take a long time for everything to fall together. But I quite agree with Dan that there's a good chance that we're going to discover exciting things with the higher energies of the Large Hadron Collider and with the wonderful observations, astronomical observations, done both from orbit and from the Earth's surface. In fact, I think the excitement in the last decade or two in physical science has been much greater coming from astronomy and astrophysics than it has been coming from particle physics. Mm-hmm. But that may change.
Jody Cooley, let's talk string theory. Is it helpful to you in your work?
Well, I think that right now, as an experimentalist, string theory isn't such a useful theory for experimentalists because we can't really measure it yet. But I think it's still important that we theorize about these things that are out there and that, you know, that maybe aren't accessible right now, because in the future it could be, as you develop these theories, that you can make them accessible to experiments. And so I think it's important that we have people who work on problems like string theory who are dreaming big, because we don't know as experimentalists what we might be able to access in the future and as the theories develop. But for right now, string theory isn't so useful, I think, for an experimentalist.
Stephen, is there a time where you have to give it up if you can't prove it? Don't you have to give up an idea in physics?
Well, I just counsel patience. You know, the atomic theory had to wait 2,000 years. I hope we don't have to wait that long, but we may. I quite agree with Jody. String theory doesn't, I mean, the thing that's wrong with it is that it hasn't led to testable predictions. And well, that's very difficult.
Yeah, I also agree
that people should go on working on it.
Are you in the camp that says we're past the stage where we have to prove everything? You know, the refutable evidence that we can't test everything anymore because we don't have to. You know, the energy.
It never was true that you had to test every consequence of theories. Newton developed this wonderful theory of gravity and motion. He was unable to test its predictions for the tides. In fact, was unable to get decent predictions because tides are so complicated. They depend on the shape of the ocean bottom. And, you know, you might have said to Newton, well, what good is your theory if you haven't predicted the height of the tide at Bristol on a particular day? That's not an appropriate attitude. Theories are confirmed when they make a sufficient number of successful predictions and explanations. They don't, and in fact, they never have predicted and explained everything, even within a limited range of phenomena.
Well, we've run out of time. This is really fascinating. We'll have you all back to get an afternoon session on this. Dan Hooper is a staff scientist at Fermilab, professor of astronomy and astrophysics, University of Chicago. Jody Cooley, associate professor of physics at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. And Steven Weinberg is a theoretical physicist, University of Texas at Austin, winner of the Nobel Prize, and author of To Explain the World, The Discovery of Modern Science, published by Harvard.
Thanks for the plug.
Yeah, well, it's a great book. I hope everybody gives it a read. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Next up, the malaria parasite Plasmodium falciparum can't travel from human to human by itself. You know, it needs to hitchhike. It needs help getting around by hitching a ride in the belly of a mosquito. And lucky for the parasite, the mosquitoes are already attracted to humans by the scent of carbon dioxide that we exhale. But the malaria parasite does one better by manufacturing a sort of perfume that might make its human hosts even more irresistible to mosquitoes. Audrey Odom is an assistant professor of pediatrics and molecular microbiology at Washington University in St. Louis, and she's the author of a study out in the journal MBio on this malarial trick. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on.
You're welcome. Let's go back to the basics. What makes humans so attractive to mosquitoes? I mentioned carbon dioxide. Are there other factors?
Yeah, so the mosquito attraction to humans is really quite complicated and very context dependent. So they're interested in warm bodies, so they want something that's at 37 degrees. They want carbon dioxide, and then there are a lot of different things that have been shown to attract mosquitoes. They like stinky feet, for instance, so they can actually be attracted to Limburger cheese.
Stinky feet? I'm not going there. let's talk about the trick that the malaria parasite has picked up, this ability to manufacture perfume.
Yeah, so we were really interested in some observations a number of researchers had made that mosquitoes are not just attracted to mammals, but particularly attracted to mammals that are infected with malaria. So there were studies in children and in mice and also in birds showing that mosquitoes would choose to bite an individual that was malaria infected rather than one that was not. And so that really suggested that there's something about when malaria is infecting people that can get out of the body. And so we went looking to see if we could find them.
And how is the perfume made?
So the the Parasite has some really interesting ways to make compounds. And one of the ways that it makes compounds is very plant-like. So the Parasite actually has an organelle that's a lot like a chloroplast. So you can think of the malaria parasite to some extent as being like a plant in the dark. It doesn't do photosynthesis, but it makes a lot of the same compounds that plants make. And it appears to use that pathway to make these perfumes.
So does it have a little plant in it that's making the perfume?
It's a little organelle like a chloroplast. Uh-huh. It's not green. It doesn't capture light, but it makes a lot of the same compounds that are made in the chloroplast of plants.
So that's an additional attractant.
Yes.
Yeah. Can we smell it at all?
You can definitely tell the smell of malaria culture in the lab,
yeah.
But I don't think that's the terpenes. I think it's mostly media, but I don't think these compounds are at the limit of detection that human noses can smell. But there are certainly lots of animals that have a much lower limit of detection than we do. We certainly are very interested in whether or not we can develop devices that have that kind of low limit of detection to use these compounds as diagnostics. Mm-hmm.
So is the mosquito attracted to this smell?
The compounds that we found have been described in the literature as mosquito attractants at low levels. At high levels, they're mosquito repellents. So we think it's a lot like perfume for people. Sometimes a little bit smells nice and a lot is repellent.
So is that like a repellent like citronella?
Exactly.
And so I guess at a low level, it sort of smells okay. But then when you get a high level,
irritating.
Yeah. Let me remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Audrey Odom about mosquitoes and parasites and malaria. You've looked at this effect in the lab dish. Do you know if malaria patients actually give off the pine or the lemon scents in their breath or on their skin?
So I think that's really the critical next experiment to be done. So we're planning field trials in Malawi to capture the breath and sweat from children with and without malaria to see if these compounds are actually present in natural human infections.
Hmm. And is there any way, of course you wouldn't be looking at it if you weren't looking for a way to combat malaria, right?
Exactly. So we're particularly interested in this from the point of view of trying to develop a new non-invasive diagnostic test for malaria. So right now, if you, you're in an endemic area and a child has a fever, to diagnose malaria, you need a little sample of blood and either a microscope and a trained observer or a rapid diagnostic test, which is relatively expensive for those areas. So right now, a rapid diagnostic test may cost as much as $1. But a course of antimalarial therapy may either be donated or cost as little as $1 or $1.25.
Wow.
And so many children don't get any diagnostic test and just get treated for malaria. And we'd really like to preserve those antimalarials for children who really need them.
Yeah, and in this age of smartphones, you could probably do some sort of app.
That's exactly what we would love to be able to do, right? Have a little device that you could hook up to a cell phone and power with a cell phone, you know, a breathalyzer test just
right.
Like the cops use. So something that would be suitable for untrained care providers that would really be, you know, field safe.
Right. So it's fascinating, Dr. Odom. Thank you for taking the time to be with us today. Good luck to you.
Oh, thanks a lot, and thanks again for having me.
You're welcome. Audrey Odom is Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Molecular Microbiology at Washington University in St. Louis, and she was the author of a study that was out in the journal MBio on this malarial trick. One last thing. What does it mean when scientists wonder what nature has in store for them? Now, here's what I mean. The Large Hadron Collider was slated to fire up this week after a pretty long vacation from physics. A full 2 years off the job, they upgraded it, lots of cutting and welding to ramp up the energy of the collider. When we listened into the press conference to hear what that souped-up machine might help scientists find and when, we heard this.
When we get the next big discovery, we just don't know at this stage. We will see what nature has in store for us.
If nature is kind to us, we could find such a particle.
It all depends. If nature is kind with us, it could be quick. And if it is less kind, well, it will take some time.
Depends on nature.
When some of you keep mentioning if the nature is kind to us, what exactly are you expecting from the nature?
Well, nature did have an answer for that journalist this week in the form of a piece of metal dust, which has delayed the machine's reboot anywhere from days to months. This time, nature was not too kind. Finally, a personal note on the passing of longtime colleague Bill Tuohy. Bill and I went back, way back. We joined NPR on the same day in 1971. He was the consummate professional and a great human being. I want to express condolences to his wife and his family. He will be missed. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Thanks to our Cosmic Cafe customer, Jennifer Kwok. And on the web this week, when an iceberg calves or breaks away from a glacier, it has a tremendous impact.
That's over 3,000 feet of ice toppling over all at once, the length of a football field and the width of 10 football fields, all just toppling all at once into the ocean.
Imagine that thing capsizing. It's our latest picture of the week. Take a look at what happens when icebergs flip. Check it out at sciencefriday.com/iceberg. I'm Ira Flatow in New York. Have a great weekend.